Good afternoon. Ms. Allen, do you want to reserve any rebuttal?
Yes, please, I'll reserve 2 minutes.
2 minutes? All right, you may proceed. Before you begin or get too comfortable, isn't the bottom line in this case?
No danger in that one.
Sorry?
No danger in that one.
Isn't the real issue here whether they were separate offenses or in terms of pleading, whether there's more than one grade of the offense carrying different punishments?
Yes, sir.
If that's the case, then it was error. And if it was simply a sentencing factor, then there's no error.
If this is construed as merely a sentencing factor, then His Honor is correct. There would be no error on Judge Warren's part. However, under the case that came out while we were actually pending sentencing, Mr. Butler's conviction was determined by Judge Warren on May 9, 2013. Mr. Butler was sentenced on June 26. Aline came out on June 17, just days before his sentence was imposed, and a supplemental brief was filed that extended to the court the argument of Aline and the interpretation Justice Thomas gave to the Sixth Amendment right for an accused to be noticed.
Is that limited to a jury trial? Isn't that Apprendi? Allen was based on Apprendi, and Apprendi had to do with if there were additional facts that were necessary for sentencing, the jury had to decide those facts.
Whether it's a judge or a jury, Your Honor, it would be for the finder of fact. I'm not convinced that it's relevant and a discernible point that we have a judge or a jury finding. We have a beyond a reasonable doubt for the fact finder of finding all facts that would be relevant to the punishment in this case. Mr. Butler, I think what's interesting is that Mr. Butler was charged on an arrest warrant for an unclassified felony and charged as a felon with having been convicted of a felony within the previous 10 years. However, the indictment did not carry forward that language. He was charged under the indictment and, as was presented to the grand jury, a Class 6 felony, which is punishable by 1 to 5 years. And it was no mention in the indictment of Mr. Butler having been convicted of a felony within the past 10 years.
Wouldn't Apprendi and Aileen or whatever, wasn't that decided in the context of Sixth Amendment right to a jury, to have the jury decide all factual matters?
In that case, yes, Mr. Aileen was tried by a jury, and a jury does discern, it does decide all factual matters.
And that was the predicate in Apprendi as well, wasn't it?
Apprendi would go to the, in my interpretation of Apprendi, it would stand for the fact that you cannot punish somebody above the maximum unless that matter was presented to the finder of fact. Judge Thomas was quite clear in his case, in his decision when he presented it to the court, that every fact that increases the punishment must be presented and must be found beyond a reasonable doubt. There was no discernment whether or not that particular matter was time of the felony. The only thing that was preserved by, the only exception that was preserved by Justice Thomas and the U.S. Supreme Court in Aline was the proposition that except as to previous felony convictions. And that is the only exception that was made to whether or not there would be an exception to the right to be noticed under your indictment. And that is, that's it. There was no other distinction as to whether or not, unless this particular felony was within 5 years, 10 years, every fact that increases the minimum or maximum sentence must be presented and must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. in Mr. Butler's case.
But that's not your argument on the appeal, is it? Your argument is that it had to be included in the indictment.
Correct, Your Honor, and it was not included in the indictment in Mr. Butler's case. Therefore, the only thing Mr. Butler could be punished for is a Class 6 felony.
I thought you said there was the exception in Alleyn, that if it's about a previous conviction, which is what's essentially involved here, is because you have this, you know, previous one here, that he gets the 2-year mandatory minimum rather than just a range.
Your Honor, yes, Mr. Butler has been convicted of felonies, many felonies. However, the indictment does not state within the previous 10 years. It merely states Mr. Butler is a person, a felon in possession of a firearm. And that is, to be quite candid with the court, true. There was, as to the guilt phase, there was no question. Mr. Butler was found in possession of a firearm on someone else's land.
Well, can I follow up then and say, where is the prejudice then? Because counsel at trial, I don't remember if you were trial counsel.
It was me, Your Honor.
Yeah, and you know, you made the statement, I believe, when we know there's a 2-year mandatory minimum.
Yes.
So where is, I mean, if the purpose, of course, in the indictment is to make sure everybody's fully aware of what they're facing, so there are no surprises and you can prepare, where would the prejudice be here?
Yes, Your Honor, I did indeed make that statement, and the only thing I can tell you as to that is there are regrettable statements made by counsel and me in particular on many occasions, and that is one of them. I would, however, acknowledge that Judge Tom Warren did bring to the forefront that particular fact and brought it to the attention of the Commonwealth's attorney, and the court sua sponte raised that issue and asked us to brief it, therefore essentially preserving that and maybe even saving me on that one. And he is, and I think it speaks volumes as to the lawyer and the judge that he is, that he did raise that issue. And you are correct in that Mr. Butler was properly charged as a felon in possession of a firearm. However, the indictment did not include the fact within 10 years. And that is the crux of this entire argument, is that if it does not include the language within 10 years in the indictment, the mandatory minimum of 2 years cannot be imposed. And then we get to what would have happened at sentencing if that mandatory minimum was not imposed. The sentencing guidelines, which are included in the record, indicate a range of sentencing between 7 months and 16 months based on Mr. Butler's previous record.
Within 10 years?
Yes.
Is that an element of the offense or is it a sentencing factor?
Your Honor, it would have to be considered an element of the offense. If we are going to be having to find this particular fact, it is an element. Under Justice Thomas's rationale in Alleyn, it must be considered an element of the offense. It is no longer a sentencing factor. The divergent paths of finding something as a sentencing factor and something as an element of the offense in this particular case is, in my opinion, extraordinarily prejudicial, especially to someone like Mr. Butler, who would have been sentenced under the sentencing guidelines to a potential maximum of 16 months. If just Judge Thomas Warren wished to go over that 16 months, he would have had to make written findings. Indeed, it was well within his discretion.
Let me ask you this. If the Commonwealth couldn't prove, you say it's within 10 years an element of the offense.
Yes, sir.
If the Commonwealth didn't prove that the prior convictions was within 10 years, is your position that he would be found not guilty? That he would simply be sentenced to a lesser time?
It would be sentenced as a Class 6 felon. It would be, I believe it does make a difference, Your Honor, and I believe it is an element of the offense that must be found beyond a reasonable doubt, and it is.
If it's an element of the offense and not proven, then the court's got to find him not guilty.
If he was charged with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon within the past 10 years, and they failed to find that fact beyond a reasonable doubt, Your Honor, he may very well have been found not guilty, or it may be construed as a lesser included offense. If it's not charged, the Commonwealth would have had the, when it was brought to the Commonwealth's attention, would have had the opportunity to perhaps amend the indictment. Prior to it being submitted to a judge or jury, the Commonwealth does have the right to amend an indictment, and that would be a whole different argument. Had they done that, I might not be here in front of you arguing this very point. However,
Can you help me on the why this case isn't governed by this court's decision in Atkins? In Atkins, it's very similar fact pattern, right?
I believe Atkins, is it Atkins or Thomas, that was almost an exact fact pattern that gave us this reliance the Commonwealth placed on this court's decisions. And I believe that particular case has been, must be viewed in a different light under the holding in Alleyne. I believe it has to be. When we have our Supreme Court justice telling us that every fact that increases the minimum sentence that can be imposed must be a fact presented and found beyond a reasonable doubt.
By the jury.
Or the finder of fact, Your Honor.
Does it say or the finder of fact?
No, it does not. I think it was, I would surmise that the reason why they continued to suggest it was finding by a jury is because Mr. Alleyne was tried by a jury.
Well, see, I might be wrong, but I was under the impression in reading Alleyne or whatever it is and Apprendi that it was limited to a jury trial, the defendant's right, constitutional right to a jury, and that they had to make certain factual findings, and it couldn't be, that responsibility couldn't be passed on to the judge, because the judge has no fact-finding role in a jury trial. Am I wrong on that?
No, sir, you are not wrong on that. The judge does not have any role in fact-finding when it comes to a jury trial. That would be something that, of course, the jury is in charge of. In a bench trial, the judge is in charge of fact-finding, and the judge must find beyond a reasonable doubt every fact that's presented to him or her. In this case, this fact was not something that Mr. Butler, for which he was indicted, it is a case simply where Judge Warren found and Judge Warren stated, you're guilty as charged. He was charged as a felon in possession of a firearm, nothing more. Charged under a Class 6 felony, which is punishable by 1 to 5 in accordance with the sentencing guidelines. Now, Judge Warren did indeed have the discretion to go as high as 5 years. That's not disputed. However, if he was going to go over the sentencing guidelines, he must make a written finding as to why he's going over the sentencing guidelines. In this case, he sentenced to 2 years, 5 years with 3 suspended, 2 years.
Let me ask you this.
Yes,
Atkins, it seems to me that Atkins controls unless these two federal Supreme Court cases overrule it or makes it not a viable decision anymore.
Yes, sir.
Oh, do we have the ability as a panel to overrule Atkins?
As a panel?
I mean, if it's going to be overruled, doesn't it have to be done en banc?
I would surmise that, yes, Your Honor, it would have to be done by more than just the panel here. I believe, Your Honor, and I believe Atkins would need to be viewed in a different light. I believe it's...
But not by this panel.
I Your Honor, I'm...
Given the inter-panel accord doctrine, that panels are bound
Even if we agree with you that Atkins is no longer good law, I don't know that we can say that. But anyhow.
That's something, you know, Your Honor, I really wish I had an answer, and I really wish I could tell you something that would make.
Okay.
I just don't know the answer.
Your time is almost up, but I'll give you another minute or so for rebuttal.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Chandeville, welcome.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Chris Chandeville. I represent the Commonwealth in this appeal. Because the court's opening question was absolutely correct, that the bottom line question in this case is whether or not Atkins is still good law. Because if Atkins is still good law, then it's absolutely controlling and dispositive. And Mr. Butler's sentence has to be
I'll ask you the same question. Assuming we think that Atkins is no longer good law, can we do anything about it at a panel level?
The legal standard, as I remember it, as to when a panel can overturn a prior panel's decision is a very high bar. And I don't remember the terminology off the top of my head, but I would argue that this panel, that test is not met in this case. This panel would not be able to overturn Atkins. However, I would argue that it is very clear, based on the Supreme Court's decision in Alleyn, also looking at Apprendi, that this court can and should hold in this case that those cases do not in any way disturb this court's decision in Atkins. And I can give two or maybe even three reasons why that's the case. The first, I think, most important reason is the fact that Alleyn and Apprendi deal primarily with the right to a jury trial. And there is some mention in there about the right to an indictment. And I think it's very important to keep the two analyses separate for one very important reason, which is the fact that a state defendant has a right to a trial by jury under the Sixth Amendment, but does not have a right to grand jury presentment and indictment under the Fifth Amendment. That right has not yet been incorporated through the 14th Amendment against the states. And as a result, no matter what Alleyn and Apprendi might have to say in dicta about the right to an indictment and what has to be included in the indictment, they cannot in any way affect this court's case law as to what should go in an indictment for a state defendant. So for that reason, first and foremost, Alleyn does not affect the controlling aspect of Atkins in any way. And that would be my first submission. And that fact is recognized in Apprendi in footnote number 3, recognizes that the Fifth Amendment right to an indictment has not yet been incorporated through the 14th Amendment. It's also recognized by the Supreme Court of this state in Muhammad and in Morissette. Those are two capital cases where the courts found that an aggravating factor does not have to be included in the indictment because the Fifth Amendment right to indictment has not yet been incorporated. It's also recognized by this court in an unpublished case, Totten versus Commonwealth, decided in 2006. And in that case, it is unpublished, but the court there relied on really my two primary arguments in reaching its decision. And those are, number one, the fact that the Fifth Amendment right to indictment has not been incorporated against the states, and so a state defendant does not have that right. And then secondly, which is my second point, which is the fact that Alleyn, in footnote number one, preserved the exception for prior convictions. And so for that alternative and equally fatal reason, opposing counsel's argument is flawed because there does remain this, even for federal defendants. So even assuming Mr. Butler had been a federal defendant, there would still be an exception which would allow him to be indicted in an indictment that does not state the prior 10 years language and still be sentenced based on that mandatory minimum.
But doesn't Apprendi and Alleyn, isn't that rooted in a Sixth Amendment right to jury analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And I think the importance of that, there are two main reasons why that's important to keep in mind. The first is the fact that the right to a jury trial can be waived. In this case, indeed, it was waived because Mr. Butler consented to a trial by the court. As such, Butler cannot come back today and argue that he had a right to have every fact proven beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury under the Sixth Amendment because he waived that right. And then secondly, it's important to keep in mind the import of the fact that the Fifth Amendment right to an indictment has not been incorporated against the states. So he has no right to have any language that the U.S. Supreme Court thinks should be included in a federal indictment. He does not have any right to have the same facts, the same language included in a state court indictment.
Can you comment further on your statements regarding footnote 1 in Alleyn and how that distinguishes our situation here and the court's holding in Atkins from what Alleyn requires?
So basically what Alleyn held was that any fact which increases the mandatory minimum has to be proven to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. And there have been times when courts, in interpreting those decisions, have extended that to include indictments as well. So read together, the argument could be made that perhaps in a case like this, a fact that increases mandatory minimum should be
included
in the
within 10 years part.
Right. That part should be included in the indictment, would be the argument. However, if you do look at footnote number one and the Supreme Court's decision in Alleen, if I can find it quickly enough, I'll just read it for you. The court cites its prior decision in Almendarez Torres v. United States. That's a 1998 decision, and that's the decision where this exception for prior convictions really originates. It's a 1998 U.S. Supreme Court decision. And in footnote number one, the Supreme Court says, in Almendarez Torres v. United States, we recognize a narrow exception to this general rule for the fact of a prior conviction. Because the parties do not contest that decision's vitality, we do not revisit it for purposes of our decision today. So that exception for prior convictions is
so
still
any
good.
Prior conviction, Ms. Allen made the point, yeah, he's got lots of prior felony convictions, but what's important in her argument, she said, is that the within 10 years. So your argument is that footnote in Alleen, footnote one,
right,
makes clear that it's not just any previous convictions, but also if the indictment fails to state within 10 years.
Well, I would argue, and I actually did some research on this morning, to see how broad the scope of this prior convictions exception has been extended by other courts. And the best case that I can give to you for that question, and I apologize for not having it ready for my brief, there's a California Supreme Court case, People versus McGee, and the site is 38 California 4th, 6, I believe that's 682. That's a 2006 case. And there they talk about this question of how broadly is the scope of this prior convictions exception. And they cite many different decisions by multiple state courts, New Jersey, Florida, Illinois, Maryland, New York, and even the Second Circuit and the Eighth Circuit Courts of Appeals. And they note the fact that all these courts have looked at this exception and said it includes not only the bare fact of a prior conviction somewhere in the record, but also attendant facts that go along with that prior conviction, such as the nature of the conviction itself, so whether it qualifies as a violent felony or an aggravated felony.
That would not need to be included in the indictment.
That would not need to be included in the indictment, correct, is what they concluded based on this exception for prior convictions.
Well, if you don't have to include the fact that there is a prior conviction, I guess why would you have to include that it was violent or that it was within 10 years?
Right. Well, there are...
Is that the that,
that
of
is,
it?
Right. That is what part of the debate in the courts has been, is this exception limited to the fact of a prior conviction, in which case you wouldn't have to include that, but maybe if you're relying more on the fact of a prior conviction and also relying on the fact that it was a violent felony, for example, then maybe that would get outside of the scope of the exception, so you should include that in the indictment. But what other courts have found is that exception is broad enough to cover the nature of the offense, and the Florida Supreme Court, in a case Wright versus State, addressed a similar issue to the issue we have before us. In that case, the question was whether the language that the felony had occurred within 5 years of the new offense, whether that should be included in the indictment. And the court there said that this exception for prior convictions is broad enough to cover the date when the offense occurred. And I think for policy reasons, it makes perfect sense. And the court alluded to the fact that this is the court in People versus McGee, the California Supreme Court, alluded to the fact that the fact finder, based on the face of the record, so the face of the prior conviction, can look at that court record and determine what type of offense it was and when that conviction occurred. So the fact finder's not doing any additional fact finding to reach that conclusion. And in addition to that, a prior conviction has gone through, you know, all the due process requirements that we would require in order to obtain a conviction. So there are fewer concerns along those lines as well. And a fact finder relying on a prior conviction on the face of that record. So for those reasons, we believe that Atkins remains good law even after Alleen, and that this court can and should hold that Atkins remains good law even after Alleen, that court's decision did not and really cannot, until the Fifth Amendment is incorporated against the states, cannot affect or overturn a decision of this court on that very issue. And as a result of that, we would ask this court to affirm the sentence. If there are no further questions from the court, I'll rely on my brief.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Allen?
Thank you.
It comes down to the very basic due process right to be charged with the nature, the crime, the nature and punishment of the crime. And right now we have Mr. Butler having been convicted of the crime for which he was charged, possession of a firearm by a felon, not within 10 years, but conviction by of a firearm by a convicted felon. That's what he was found guilty of. That's what he should have been punished for. Instead, he was punished for a different crime. Possession of a firearm by a convicted felon within 2 years, and that is an entirely different crime, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll greet counsel.